Hi guys, how's it going? We're gonna finish up our consciousness slides and talk a little bit about meditation and drugs, and then we're gonna move on to sensation, okay? There'll be some announcements when we start the next section. But just so it's on your radar, you know your assignment is due next Tuesday by 5 p.m., so by the end of class, right? So make sure you're working on that. Any questions on that lingering assignment one? There are guidelines for meditation options posted on BSpace. Look under resources, assignments, and you'll find them. No? Okay. All right, so let's talk about meditation then. Remember last time we were talking about consciousness, this kind of idea of awareness, and what is it, and who are we, and how do we know that we exist, and how do we know that we're aware? And we were talking before about hypnosis, right, which is kind of an altered state of consciousness. And so we're going to talk now about meditation, which is another kind of altered state of consciousness, or way of focusing on our consciousness, that I hope to show you has a lot of cool benefits. So, definition of meditation, the mental practice of training attention and awareness, generally to gain better control over your mental processes. Okay, there are many types. Here are four. These are the four, by the way, that I've asked you to choose from for your assignment. So you have concentrative attention, where you focus your attention on just one thing, right? So perhaps the breath, and you focus only on inhaling and then exhaling. And if your attention wanders anywhere else, you bring it back and focus just on that one thing. So the exercise is in honing your attention in on just one object. Mindfulness meditation is a little different. This is about having kind of an open consciousness and being mindful and aware of whatever may arise while you attend consciously to the totality of your experience. So you think about every single aspect of tasting something, right? Tasting candy or tasting gum or tasting a meal, and you very slowly eat and you pay attention to every single sensation that arises, okay? Mindfulness meditation. And that doesn't have to necessarily be about eating, right? But that's one way to think about it, is focusing on every single feature of that experience. Reflective meditation is about choosing a theme or topic, like, what is the meaning of life, right? And reflecting on it, contemplating on it, trying to come up with an answer to it, analyzing this question. Loving kindness meditation is where you draw upon the other techniques to practice kindness and compassion and empathy, beginning with yourself, right? So first you learn to love yourself, and then you extend that loving kindness, compassion to everyone else in the world, right? Slowly but surely you work your way through like your social circles and your friends and then humanity and then animals and then everything in existence, right? Extending this kind of feeling of compassion and love towards all beings. Okay, so four different types of meditation. So why should we do this? What are some benefits? I have a couple of videos to show you. And while I show you this first video, it's about a study, okay, so I'm going to ask you to figure out what was the design, what was the independent variable, the dependent variable, the results, etc. Okay, so kind of keep that in mind as we go. I'll pull up the video.
For Chris Callio, a painter, martial artist, and businessman, meditation is exercise for his mind.
Meditation is kind of like my emotional gym to help me build from the inside out. It's kind of like emotional push-ups.
But does meditation actually change our brains? At the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Richard Davidson wanted to answer that question. So he randomly assigned 41 volunteers to two different groups. One group received meditation training and practiced it for 8 weeks. The other served as a control group and did not meditate during the study. Then researchers used electrodes like these to measure electrical activity in the front part of participants' brains.
This is a very, very important part of the brain that is involved in the integration of thought and emotion and the control and regulation of emotion.
They found the meditation group showed increased activity in the left frontal part of the brain, colored blue, compared to the control group. The changes appeared even 4 months after the study. Davidson thinks that means there's a lasting effect on people who meditate.
It means that they will be able to deal with negative emotions more effectively, and they will have a more hopeful and positive outlook, more positive expectations about the future.
Chris Callio agrees.
There's this great saying that when you can't stop the waves, you can learn how to surf.
And I think that meditation is learning how to surf.
So he can ride the waves of life. I'm Brad Wood.
Okay. All right, so back to our discussion. Okay, so what was the study that we just learned about, right? Okay, so what is the design? Is it correlational, experimental, observation? What was it?
Experimental,
correct. Okay, so why was it experimental? What were they manipulating? What were the conditions in this study? Yes. Exactly, very good. So meditation versus not is the independent variable, right? Some people were trained to meditate, some were a control group. They were randomly assigned to these groups, and random assignment helps with what again? What is the advantage of random assignment? Why is it important? Say again? In what way? Yes. A better representation of our population. That would be random sampling, but close. Yes. Okay, it controls the variables, but in what way? Why do we randomly assign people? Yeah? To remove confounding variables? Yeah, so you're getting at the right idea, which is that it evens out our groups. It should spread out people who are high and low in extroversion, high or low in interest in meditation equally, right? If everyone has a random chance of being in either group, you should have relatively equivalent groups to begin. So random assignment helps with confounding variables of like background personality measures, right? You want them to be evenly distributed across your groups, okay? You should be able to answer these questions for your exam in 2 weeks, FYI. Okay, DV, what was measured in this study? What was the outcome? Yes? Okay, electrical activity in the brain, good. So brain activity, specifically in the left frontal lobe region, which is an important region for integrating thought, emotion, and controlling emotion. Okay, so how would you phrase the results in plain English? What happened? Yes. A better thinker. Okay, so meditation does have an effect on thought. That's good. Yes? Good. Great. So meditation increased activity in the left frontal lobe relative to control, and these results also lasted for 4 months. Okay, so this was not just a temporary increase. This was a lasting change. Okay? So meaning, how would you like tell your mom about this study? Why is this important? What is the actual implication of this? So there's more brain activity. Who cares? What does it mean? Has an effect on the brain. Good. What effect? Yeah. A positive effect. Sure. Okay. So meditation causes better coping with negative emotion, a more positive outlook. It increases your integration between your thoughts and your emotions, and it increases your ability to control your emotions. Okay? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great. Yes, no, you're totally right. It's a totally valid and excellent critique that, okay, so we're seeing more brain activity, who cares, right? How do we know that it's even related to these things? How do we know that it even contributes to these processes? The answer is more research. So I'm sure that he conducted other kind of assessments besides just brain activity to get at emotional control and thought and emotion kind of integration and controlling emotion, as I said. So a better ability to cope with negative emotion. You're totally right that just brain activity, I don't think it's that interesting as an outcome variable either, right? Unless you connect it to something real. Okay? Other thoughts on this study? Okay, so this is one perk of meditation. Now I have another video.
Some people meditate to clear their minds or to relieve the stress of daily life. Others hope to find. find enlightenment.
Meditating is about training the mind in effect, training the mind to be more focused and to be more mindful moment to moment.
But the benefits of meditation may not just be in the mind. Massachusetts General Hospital's Sarah Lazar says she can see physical changes in the brains of people who meditate.
Meditation can have a serious impact on your brain long beyond time when you're sitting and actually meditating, and this may have a positive impact on your day-to-day living.
Lazar compared MRI brain scans of people who meditate for about 45 minutes every day with scans of non-meditators. She found that certain areas of the cortex, the outer layer of the brain that contains our thinking, reasoning, and decision-making functions, were significantly thicker in the meditators.
One of them is right up in the front of your brain, right above your right eye. And this is an area that's involved in decision-making and in working memory, short-term working memory.
Lazar and her colleagues think the thickening could help to counteract the natural thinning of the cortex that occurs as we get older.
It's not a cure-all, but perhaps can help prevent the loss of some functions.
Lazar's next study will investigate whether meditation affects mental ability over time. I'm Brad Wilson.
Okay, cool. So, some complementary effects. Right, so besides just increasing your ability to control your emotions, it also affects your decision-making ability and your short-term memory, right, according to this research. So, a little more info on what meditation does. There's also a lot of cool work being done here at Cal by Bob Levinson and his colleagues in my department, and they've studied meditation's effects in a couple different ways. They looked at a Buddhist monk who'd been meditating for 40 years, and they startled him. They scared him, okay? They scared him, and they scared someone who is matched in kind of age and demographics to him. And they saw how they reacted, and the Buddhist monk kept his kind of zen, right? He was much less reactive after being startled compared to similar controls, okay? Suggesting that perhaps meditation helps your ability to control your emotional reactions to unexpected events, right? There's also some effects done by Jocelyn Z, who's a graduate student in our department, looking at how meditation affects how attuned you are to your own body and your own emotions, your own kind of physiological reactions. She thought maybe meditators would be comparable to professional dancers in this respect, because dancers have to also be aware of their body, right, and be aware of what's going on with them, be able to control it very precisely. So she compared meditators to professional dancers, both ballet and modern dancers. And what she did was she had them watch an emotional movie and continuously report on their emotions as they were watching. Okay. At the same time, their physiology, their actual emotional, physical responses were being measured. Emotion is manifested in the body in a lot of different ways, and so you can measure the physiology of the emotion at the same time that someone is reporting on it consciously and see how well those two sorts of reports cohere, okay, to see if people are actually reporting accurately on their own emotions. And she found that meditators' reports of their emotions were much more closely attuned to their physiology than the dancers. Okay, there was a better correspondence between self-report and physiology for meditators than for dancers. Okay, kind of cool, right? Showing that it affects our coherence of our own experience, both kind of consciously and physiologically. So what's the design type here? What did she do in this study? Was there a random assignment? No, right? So what does that mean? Why might that not be a great thing? Doesn't mean it's not interesting, right? Yes. Okay, so how might it be? Yeah, so why might it be biased? Like, what kind of negative thing? You're totally right, you're on the right track, but like, what exactly? Did I see a hand? No? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe there's some kind of pre-existing difference, right? It seems like there is a difference in these groups. We call this a quasi-experimental design because it was not randomly assigned. It was based on prior kind of definitions of who they were, right? It's like taking men and women and assigning them to do different things. This is similar because it's taking dancers and meditators, right? Some kind of pre-existing variable that you're using as an independent variable. So not something we've learned about in this class, but just an FYI, a lot of studies are done this way, comparing naturally existing groups, right? Okay, so who meditates here? Anybody? Do you agree with these benefits? Do you see these benefits in yourself? Not all of them, some of them. What kind of things have you experienced?
Like,
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's great. Cool. So you were like focusing on kind of things going on in your life and able to. Yeah, yeah. So it started coming up more. That's really cool. Yeah. Uh-huh. That's a good question. So is it just a placebo effect, an expectancy effect, that you think it's going to have this effect, and so it does? It's a good question. How would you design something to test that? How would you parse it apart? It's a valid critique. I love the way you're thinking. But how do you design a placebo meditation? Do you tell people that it helps versus hurts and then see how they react? Don't know what it is at all. Yeah, that's a good idea. Find naive people. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, cool. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great. That's so cool. Yeah, I think you're not the only one in here who's in the meditation class, but that's really awesome. Thank you for sharing. I agree. Taking an hour to just like focus on something besides work can do wonders and make you 10 times more productive, right? Wow. That's really cool. I love that. So forcing people to meditate and seeing what it does. Cool. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. So that's a drop in your circadian rhythm, yeah. Maybe it's somewhere. I mean, it's in the same chapter as sleep, right? This is consciousness. It's the same kind of idea. So totally related that sleep is a form of consciousness. It's a state of consciousness. So maybe it's somewhere in between, right? Maybe it's a spectrum. I totally know what you mean. Cool. All right. Great. So meditation, highly recommended. If you want to do it for assignment one, you should start today because you only have a week. So maybe consider this as an option. Okay. Cool. So moving on to drugs and consciousness. So, how many of you have used drugs today? I have. Okay, yep. So, how many of you guys have taken drugs in the brain? It's a really cool class. Highly recommended if you have any time left here. So let's talk about some of the biggies and the major classes and their effects, and then you can read about the rest in your textbook. Okay, the things about tolerance and dependence, social influences on drug use, you can read that. We're just going to talk for a couple minutes. So depressants are one major class, right? These calm your neural activity and slow your bodily functions. Alcohol, most prevalently used depressant. We know it slows neural processing, slows your reaction time, does things like slurring your speech. It also lessens your inhibition and your self-control, lessens your self-awareness, disrupts your memory formation, perhaps because it suppresses REM sleep, which we know is important for memory consolidation. There are expectancy effects, similar to like placebo effects, like what we were just talking about, with alcohol. So if you make people believe that alcohol creates a certain effect and then lead them to believe that they've consumed alcohol, what are they going to do? They're going to act in line with that belief, okay? So one cool study of this told participants that alcohol increases sexual stimulation, okay? This is one effect of alcohol. And then they gave participants an alcoholic drink that was either a real drink or a fake drink, right? Placebo drink, strongly flavored, but no actual vodka in it. And then they showed them an erotic clip, a little movie. And what do you think they found? Predictions. Did the people who drank the alcohol act any differently than those who did not drink the alcohol but thought they did? No, right? So both the people who actually got alcohol and the placebo groups report stronger sexual fantasies and less guilt over those fantasies than people who believe they had not consumed alcohol. Okay? So there is this expectancy effect that you can trick people into thinking that they're drinking and then tell them that alcohol has a certain effect, and then they will show you that effect, even if they're not actually drunk. Okay? Classic study. Okay. This is silly. It's just a little clip. I just love it. Do you guys watch Parks and Rec? Yeah. I wanted this to be looping, but it's not. It's just Ron Swanson dancing. Okay. Anyway, we all know alcohol's effects, right? Stimulants are another class of drugs. So these excite our neural activity, opposite of depressants, right? Speed up our bodily functions, our energy, our self-confidence. We've got nicotine here. This is a stimulant. This increases our heart rate and our blood pressure, but it also makes you feel relaxed, right? Perhaps because it releases dopamine in your system, which is rewarding and addictive. Each cigarette, I kind of like this fact, lasts about 12 minutes, and it takes about 12 minutes off your life, right, according to your textbook. So a very real cost, right, associated with this. Caffeine is the most used psychoactive drug. This is the drug I've used today. It's an antagonist for adenosine. Do you remember this? Who can tell me what this was? What makes you tired? Adenosine makes you tired, yes. And what is an antagonist? Very good. It blocks the effects. So caffeine blocks the effects of this neurotransmitter, this substance in our body that makes us get sleepier throughout the day, right? Perking us up. Cocaine, you can get the same placebo expectancy effects with cocaine as you can with alcohol. Meth and ecstasy are also stimulants. Hallucinogens are another big class of drugs. So these distort our perceptions and evoke sensory images in the absence of sensory input, right? You see things that might not be there, hence they are called psychedelics. LSD, or acid, is a very powerful hallucinogenic drug. Hoffman, who created this and was the first guy to trip, described it as an uninterrupted stream of fantastic pictures. It leads to a wide range of emotions and sensation, sometimes dissociation from reality and from yourself. Marijuana, THC being its active substance, acts on the cannabinoid receptors in the brain, the same receptors that Tylenol acts on. Okay, so it has the same pain-killing effects as Tylenol. It's a mild hallucinogen in that it enhances the sensitivity of your senses. It also relaxes and disinhibits you and produces a mild euphoria, makes you feel good, right? It impairs your motor coordination and your perception, your reaction times, your attention, your memory formation, lots of kind of negative consequences. But it is useful for pain relief, as I mentioned, and also for appetite enhancement and sleep for people who are plagued by the absence of those things. Mushrooms, there's some really cool work that's been done on mushrooms recently, so I want to tell you about it. The active ingredient being psilocybin. We know that the use of magic mushrooms dates back for a very long time, thousands of years, right? These are kind of ancient representations of mushrooms. There's prehistoric imagery in murals and rock paintings of mushrooms. Their effects include euphoria, hallucinations, changes in perception, a distorted sense of time, spiritual experiences, and they lead to a greater appreciation of art, music, and nature, greater creativity and imagination. They also make you more tolerant of others. The intensity and duration of mushrooms vary, usually 2 to 6 hours. Timothy Leary did a lot of work at Harvard in the 60s to map this out. He wrote a cool book about it. It can cause lasting changes, this is the cool part, in personality and your experiences. Okay, so 40% of participants in lab studies claim positive long-term changes after using psilocybin in their aesthetic experience and their relationship with nature and the environment. It changes how you experience the world and how you interact with nature. And we know personality is generally stable in adulthood, but there was some cool work done at Johns Hopkins last year where they asked hallucinogen-naive participants to take mushrooms, and they saw what happened, okay? So this was a well-educated group. 54% of them had postgraduate degrees. They recruited them via a flyer about using mushrooms and self-reflection. They were a spiritually active group, 90% of them had a regular prayer, meditation, or prayer or meditation practice, or they attended religious services. There was no monetary compensation involved. It was purely motivated by curiosity about mushrooms, right, and this opportunity for self-reflection. And then they dosed them with mushrooms, or a placebo, or a control, and they did different amounts. So they looked at the effects of the high-dose sessions, where they administered 30 milligrams of mushrooms per 70 kilograms of body weight. And they measured mystical experiences during the trip. What does that mean? It means feelings of unity and interconnectedness with all people and things, feelings of sacredness, peace, joy, transcending normal time and space, and the belief that experience reveals truth about the nature of reality. Okay, so they saw whether people had this kind of mystical experience during their trip, and then they measured the personality trait of openness before and after this experience. Openness describes how open you are to new ideas, how creative you are, how intellectually curious, interested in art and aesthetics, and imaginative you are. Okay? So, what happened? Here we find a positive correlation between the degree of mystical experience that people had and their change in openness. So you see, with a greater level of mystical experience during their trip, they had a greater increase in this personality trait of openness. Another way of looking at it is comparing openness levels before and after the trip, which is pre and post, right? And they split the data between people who did have a mystical experience, a complete one, whatever that means in their world, versus an incomplete or lack of mystical experience. And they saw that really it was the people who had this mystical experience who experienced the increase in openness, right? See, their levels of openness increased significantly compared to those who did not have this experience during their trip. And the cool thing is that changes in openness persisted 1 year after this study. Okay, so generally, openness declines across the lifespan by a rate of about 1 T point per decade. And this experience caused an increase in excess of 4 T points. Okay, so it had a very large effect. Okay, did I see a question? Yeah. How did they do it legally? Well, I think it's like medical research. They have the ability to work with drugs that are not always legal to study their effects in a way where they propose it should have good effects, then ethically sometimes they can get away with it. Yeah. Good question. You probably can't get away with this study. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how do you think that would have affected things? I think you're right that their sample... Okay, so bias, so what is that? Right. To see whether, it's important to determine whether this effect would hold for people who are not interested in spiritual experiences. Right, who haven't already sought it out on their own. Right, 90% of this sample was spiritually active. It's a great critique. So wait, what was their design quickly? What was their independent variable? What did they manipulate? Amount of mushrooms, yes, and also there was a placebo and a control group, right? And then what did they measure? Mystical experience and openness. Very good. Okay, cool. So we think that maybe there's some kind of selection effect. So what would you want to study next? What's missing from this study? And what would you want to follow up with? Do you think these findings are bogus? Do you think there's something wrong here? Do you think they're interesting? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, right. Would it hold for people who aren't interested in this at all? Yeah, good. You might scare the living daylights out of them. Yeah. Other questions or ideas? So we just want to run it on people who are not totally spiritual? I think that's a good extension. Yeah. You can also do it on people who don't have those. Yeah, it's a highly educated, kind of weird group, so... be good to get a broader sample of the population. Great. Okay, any other thoughts on this? Okay. Cool. So now we're going to move on to sensation and perception. Okay, switching gears a little bit. We are moving on from consciousness into chapter 6 on sensation and perception. Okay? So, a few announcements. I know they're coming at kind of a weird time, but maybe you're paying attention now anyway. So I put up a tentative rubric for the assignment one, along with the assignment one guidelines, okay? This is not a solid rubric. I reserve the right to change it. I can't promise you it's going to stay exactly the same. It always changes as we grade in a way that works in your favor, okay? Once we see the kind of typical errors, we usually make that less of a penalty if everybody's making that mistake, et cetera. But it should still give you a good idea of how grading is going to work. In general, the grader will assume that you get full credit and then deduct points from there rather than making you build it up from the ground, which usually results in higher grades, okay? But there are no other changes besides adding the rubric to these assignment options, okay? So remember, these are due next week. Your exam is the week after that, 2 weeks from today, 9:25. Okay, I'm going to put up a study sheet, study guide by next Tuesday or on next Tuesday, but all it's going to be is a list of terms, okay? So don't get too excited about it, but it will still give you a pretty comprehensive idea of what it is that you're responsible for. I started typing it up today, and there is a lot, okay? So make sure you're reading. Make sure you're keeping up with everything. It's going to be better in the long run. Okay, and next Thursday, I anticipate the lecture won't take the whole time, and so I wanted to use that time as kind of a review session for you guys, for you to ask questions about the material in the class thus far, okay, a Q&A thing, so that you have time outside of office hours to talk to me and ask questions and have other people help you figure it out, okay? So start studying soon, okay, so that you can come with questions next Thursday. If there are no questions, I'm not going to have anything prepared, okay? So I will answer whatever questions you bring next Thursday, and that's it. Clear? Any questions on administrative things? Okay. Yeah. Yep. All multiple choice. Okay. Cool. Oh, if you, it's just if you start working on a study guide and you think it would be useful for me to look at it or it could be helpful in me creating the study guide for the class, feel free to send it my way. I would love to incorporate extra stuff from you guys. Okay. Just to save me some work. Yeah. I don't know how many questions yet, but it will be definitely doable within this time period. Okay? Yeah? Old exams? Nope. Sorry. First time teaching the class, first exam, no old exams. That's all there is to it. Okay. But you guys are very good test takers by this point, right? So you'll be just fine. Okay, so outline. What we're going to talk about today and Thursday. First, we're going to start with the basic principles of sensation and perception. Then we're going to talk about all of the senses kind of in order: vision, hearing, somatosensation, meaning touch, pain, and body position and movement, and then taste and smell. Okay. So, basic principles we're going to run through so you have an idea of where we're going. First, what is sensation? What is perception? What is transduction? What are thresholds? What is sensory adaptation? What is a perceptual set? Context effects? And then how do emotion and motivation play into sensation and perception? So, sensation versus perception. What is it? No! Sorry. Thanks, PowerPoint. Give me a second. Apologies. My computer is stupid. Okay, so what is sensation versus perception? Sensation is how the receptors in our body transduce physical energy into neural energy. How do we actually take the physical input from the world around us, right, these light waves and sound waves, and transduce it, meaning turn it into electrical signals within your body, right, things that your neurons can actually work with. So this is the detection of external stimulus energy, sensation, all right? This is a form of bottom-up processing, because you start at the sensory receptors and work up from the very basic units that your sensory receptors kind of collect from the world around you. Bear with me with these ideas. We'll go over them many times. Perception, in contrast to sensation, is our conscious experience of the stimuli. Okay, so sensation is how do we actually take these light waves and turn them into neural energy. Perception is how do we make sense of visual input, right? How do we see color? How do we see optical illusions? How do we see and process motion? So it's our experience of the world that's supported by the brain's further processing of sensory signals. Okay, so sensation gives you the input, You process it, interpret it, and that gives rise to perception. Does that make sense? Okay. Perception is what you can think of as top-down processing, in that it constructs perceptions of our sensory input from prior experience, right, in higher-order knowledge structures. We know kind of what something looks like or how something should behave, and that affects our perception of it. Okay, so transduction is the process by which our sensory receptors transform physical energy, like light, pressure, gravity, sound, into electrical energy, neural signals. Okay, and we'll go through how that happens for each of the senses in turn. Okay, so thresholds. We have a few different kinds of thresholds. The first is the detection threshold, or the absolute threshold, and this is the lowest amount of stimulus energy needed to produce a sensation or perception. Okay, you can also think of it as the point at which you can detect a signal 50% of the time, above chance, right? You flash a very dim light at someone, and they will say, do you see the light or do you not, yes or no? Once that light hits the point where they can detect it more than 50% of the time, more than it looks like they're just guessing, you've found their absolute threshold. Okay? So for vision, this might be kind of amazing to you guys. We can see a candle flame from 30 miles away. That is our absolute threshold for vision. For touch, the least we can feel is the wing of a bee falling on our cheek. And for smell, it's a single drop of perfume in a three-room apartment. Okay, so just giving you an idea of the very basic sensitivity we have. Subliminal stimuli, you may be wondering, yes, they do exist, right? So there are things out there that we can perceive, but we do so in a way that's below our awareness. Okay, so liminal meaning boundary or threshold, and sub meaning below. So there are subliminal stimuli where we will detect them consciously less than 50% of the time because they're below our absolute threshold, but they do affect our behavior. Okay, so visual priming, you can flash a stimulus very briefly and cover it with a mask, meaning another image to replace it. And then the information does get to the visual cortex, but it's not consciously processed. Okay, so there are stimuli that you have coming into your system that you're not aware of, but that do affect how you behave. So an example, this is a little priming study. So they subliminally flashed a nude figure, either in your right or left visual field. Okay, this figure was either male or female. And then they masked it immediately with these colored blocks, right? So you would see this back image very briefly, subliminally, right? You wouldn't consciously process it. And then it would be replaced by these color images right here. The other side of the visual field was just a scrambled image, okay? And then after they showed these colored blocks, they showed a geometric figure on one side or the other, and participants had to estimate the angle of that figure, okay? So it was just a little pair of lines, and they had to estimate what the angle was. And they showed how, they measured, rather, how accurate that estimate of the angle was. So what do you think happened for straight men versus gay men in this study? When were they more accurate? When were they actually paying attention to the figure? So remember, there's a nude figure being masked, and then there's an angle, and they have to estimate the degree of that angle. Okay, and it's either shown in the same place where the nude image was or the opposite. So what, do you have guesses about what happened? If not, I will walk you through it. What do you think happened for straight men? When were they more accurate? When it appeared in the same place as the nude figure or the opposite place? Same. How about for gay men? Opposite. Okay. All right. And if the figure was male, the nude figure, what do you think happened for gay men? Same. Okay. So what does this mean then? What's going on in this study? How is it that people are differing in the accuracy of their estimates of the angle if they can't consciously perceive the figure? What's going on? Walk me through it. You had answers. How are you getting there? Yeah.
I'm having a hard time seeing the angle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They just showed like a geometric figure. Right? And they said, estimate this angle. And they flashed that either in the same place where the nude figure had been or the opposite place. Okay. After they saw the color blocks.
So they showed three.
Yep.
The color.
Exactly. Three things in order. Thank you for clarifying. Yeah, so it started with the nude figure, and then the color blocks, and then an angle, either in the same place or opposite place as the nude photo. So what was going on? What's the effect of the subliminal nude image here? What's it doing? Yeah.
Is that
Very good. Great. So they were unconsciously drawn to the image that reflected their sexual orientation, right? And then they were able to better attend to the angle when it was flashed in that same place, and they were able to make more accurate estimates. Is that clear? So they're drawn to the image, even though they didn't consciously process it. It was subliminally flashed. They attended to that side of their vision more, and then they were able to better process the angle when it was briefly flashed. Okay? This is described in your textbook as well. Do you have a question on this before we move on? Okay. All right. Cool. So now you know what priming is. So difference thresholds, so besides the absolute threshold, we also have differences, thresholds in the kinds of differences that we can actually detect. This is known as the discrimination threshold, the difference threshold, or the just noticeable difference. Lots of names for this one. So Weber's law states how much two stimuli have to differ by in order for us to detect a change. Okay, so if I had you pick up a 5-pound weight and then a 10-pound weight, you would be able to easily tell me which one was heavier, right, and to say that these are not the same weight. If instead I had you pick up a 100-pound weight versus a 105-pound weight, it would be probably harder for you to detect whether those things were the same weight, right? Because the meaning of that 5-pound difference changes based on the amount of weight already kind of present in the system. Okay, so for the first example, it was 50% difference, right? For the second example, it's just a 5% difference, only 5 pounds different. We know that because the significance of those 5 pounds changes, we have to calculate difference thresholds using percentages or ratios, okay, rather than an absolute amount. So for weight, you have a 2% just noticeable difference. So you'll be able to notice the difference between a 100-pound weight and a 102-pound weight, but not between a 100-pound and a 101-pound weight, okay, because you have a 2% threshold. For light, it's an 8% threshold. And for sound, it's a 0.3% threshold. So you can see that our perception of sound is much more sensitive. You're much more attuned to changes in pitch than you are to changes in weight. It takes only a 0.3% difference in the stimulus for you to detect a change. Does that make sense? Okay, just noticeable difference. Sensory adaptation is another concept. So the idea here is that constant exposure to a non-changing stimulus makes us eventually less aware of it. Okay, so if you are exposed to a stimulus, right, like a smell or a sound or a light, after a while you stop noticing that it's there, as long as it's not changing. Right? Can you think of an example of this? You're not noticing something that originally was very salient to you? Yeah. Smell of horse stables, good. Or the smell of a dorm room, perhaps, right? The smell of stinky feet. All of these things you might at first be just like blasted by, right, and thrown off by, and then after a few minutes you don't even notice that it's there, right, because you have adapted your senses. So how does advertising use this information to its advantage? What does advertising do to overcome this sensory adaptation? Yep, quickly moving pictures, absolutely. So when you're scrolling through a web page and you see an ad on the side that's like blown up and like, you know, creating all of these things moving around the screen, you're much more likely to attend to that than something that you can just scroll past passively, right, which you would adapt to. Does that make sense? So lots of constantly changing sounds and images, et cetera, are used in advertising to overcome sensory adaptation and draw your attention. Okay. This happens because our nerve cells fire less frequently. Originally, you're getting all of these signals of this nasty smell in your dorm room, right? And then eventually, those nerve cells stop firing. So why do you think this happens? Why would we become less aware over time of a non-changing stimulus? Is there an advantage to this? Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, so you're learning. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, but so why is that? Why would it be a good thing for us to get used to things and to not fire as much? Yeah. Exactly. Attention is a limited resource, right, as we learned before. And so if we can streamline things and stop attending to this constant non-changing stimulus, we can devote our attention to other stuff, right, which is more important. There's no reason to keep smelling this smell forever if you already know it's there. okay, and it's not changing. Things that are changing in our environment need much more of our attention for us to survive, okay? So why don't things just disappear from vision, right, if you get used to these sensory kind of stimuli? Because of eye saccades. So our eyes are always making tiny movements. If you look at this image here on the left and the image on the right is eye tracking data to see where people attend and how many parts of the face they look at when they look at this image. So even though you might think that you're just staring like right at her nose and peripherally processing everything else, your eyes are actually darting around rapidly, processing many aspects of this face. Okay? Your eyes are constantly making these tiny little adjustments. Clear? Okay, so if you find a way to kind of short-circuit this this visual system and prevent the saccades from letting you gather more information, meaning if you force a constant image in the eye, an image that moves with the eye. So you can see this woman has this little device attached to her eye that projects a constant image onto the retina, which we'll get to in a second. Weird things start to happen as the sensory system fatigues. So you can see here in image B, originally she sees like a head and a triangle, HB and the word beer, and then pieces of it kind of disappear and come back. It's this weird experience where she's forced to look at this image continuously, and her visual system starts to adapt and drop out different features, and then it shifts a little bit. Okay, so this is what sensory adaptation in the eye looks like. Kind of cool. Okay, so perceptual sets, another kind of basic principle. Perceptual sets are a set of mental tendencies and assumptions that greatly affect what we perceive, what we taste, hear, feel, and see. So you might be affected in terms of what you taste if you know how much a bottle of wine costs, right? If it's $2 chuck versus like a $200 bottle at a restaurant, you might expect different perceptions of that wine, okay? Funnily enough, if you manipulate, if you give everybody the same kind of wine and you tell some people it was $5 and some it was $95, people who thought it was $95 like it more, right? Think it tastes better. So this is affected. In terms of hearing, if you are hanging out in a mine for some reason versus on a boat, you might hear the word "or" in different ways, right? Based on the meaning relevant to that context. In terms of interpersonal perception, I love this effect, that if you give a person a coffee cup to hold, and it either contains hot coffee or iced coffee, it changes things, okay? So if they're holding a hot cup of coffee, they feel like a warmer person, and they like other people more, and they think other people are more warm towards them. And if they're holding the iced coffee, they feel like a colder person, and they think other people are less friendly and warm. Okay, so sensation and perception, perceptual sets can affect our interpersonal perception as well. Clear? Okay, and then if I asked you, when you're looking at this image, were you in high school band versus did you call your mom today, it might affect what you see in this image, right? Because this is the first of our 1 million optical illusions for today. You can see that if you kind of degrade it in different directions, you can get either an image of a woman or an image of a saxophonist. Okay? But this kind of middle-level image could be interpreted either direction based on your perceptual set that's activated. Is that clear? Okay. Great. So gender, you can think of as a perceptual set, right? Why do we dress our babies up in pink and blue? Why do we do these gendered things? And then what the hell do you do with this baby in the middle? What does this mean? Don't you want to know, is this a boy or a girl? When you meet people, when you meet their dogs or their babies, do you ask if it's a boy or a girl? Why? What does it tell you? Why should it matter? It has zero sex characteristics, right? It's a baby or a dog. It's really not relevant to your experience with it. Why do you want to know? I ask too. I'm not saying I don't, but why is it that you want to know? Sorry? Say again?
Curiosity.
Okay, good. Absolutely. Yeah, so it affects how you understand the baby and then also how you act towards it. So if you tell people that this baby in yellow is a boy, they're going to give it different kinds of toys to play with, right? More likely to give it little like trucks and footballs and play more roughly with the baby and toss him around, right? Call him big and tough and strong. And if it's a girl, you're going to offer her dolls and call her pretty and hold her very carefully, right? And be very sweet and nurturing. You're less likely to call a female baby strong or brave, right? So gender absolutely affects how we perceive things, people, babies specifically. Right? Isn't that cool? I love that effect. So gender is absolutely a perceptual set. So why is it? What do you guys ask if it's a boy or girl, and why do you think you do it? Other than curiosity. Yeah. Yeah, the pronoun use, yeah, that's good, practical, yeah. But what else? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. Yeah, so in terms of semantics, yes, being able to call it, he, she, the right thing, and not a hand. Any other thoughts? Besides just language. Does it make you, yeah. Make conversation. Okay, that's good. It also just make you feel like you understand more about this baby and you can predict more, right? A better anticipation of what should happen with this baby. We like to understand things as people, right? But this is kind of a silly thing. So I challenge you not to ask next time you play with the baby. Play with it in a totally gender-neutral way. See what happens. Okay, see if you freak out the mom. Okay, so gender is a perceptual set. Okay, culture also affects our perceptual sets. Right? If you ask people to describe this scene, what is above the seated woman's head? What do you guys think? Window. Absolutely. In our culture, right? If you show this to somebody in a culture that does not have these linear formations in their buildings, you'll find results like people thinking that this family is sitting outside under a tree and that it's like a metal box balanced on her head. Okay? So our culture absolutely informs how it is that we perceive and make sense of this scene. Okay? Kind of cool. Okay, so emotion. How do emotion and motivation play into this? They also influence perception, right, as you might expect. So when you're walking to a class that you dread, right, versus a date that you're really excited for, when will the hill seem steeper? Which one? Class, right? Before your 10-mile hike versus after it, the last half-mile walk to the parking lot is going to seem a lot longer after the hike, right? When you're totally exhausted and you have no motivation left. Right after a fight versus a pleasant lunch with a friend, you might be more likely to see an object as a gun after a fight rather than a cell phone. Okay, we know that there are absolutely stereotypes about this as well with different ethnic groups. If you have a team known for bad fouls versus very good behavior on the field, the ref will assign different levels of penalties to the exact same video. Okay. If you, as like a softball player, are batting well this season versus batting poorly, you're going to see the softball as being a different size. Okay. So if you're batting well, do you think you're going to see it as larger or smaller? Larger, right? An easier target, easier to connect with. And if you're feeling poor versus feeling rich today, it might affect how actually large you draw a dollar bill, right? Estimating how large it is. If you're feeling poor, you're going to see that dollar bill is huge, right? If you're feeling rich, it's just this little nothing. It's like that big, right? So emotion and motivation absolutely affect our perceptions. So fun facts for cocktail parties, right? Okay. So moving on to vision, which is the most complex of our senses. We're probably going to spend the rest of today on it. Lots of cool optical illusions and things, and we'll get to the other senses on Thursday. Okay, so a little preview of all the sensory systems we're going to talk about. We have the five classic senses, right? Taste, smell, hearing, sight, and touch. And then we also have a sense of our bodily position, kinesthesia. And then we have a sense of balance from our vestibular system. And we'll talk about all of these. But we'll start with vision. Okay, this is your eyeball, right? We have several different aspects of its structure you can check out. But basically, light comes in through the cornea, right, through the pupil, is projected through the lens, creates an image on the retina, and then information is processed and sent to the brain. We're going to talk about all of these steps. So we're going to talk about sensation in vision and then perception in vision. Okay, so sensation, you remember, asks what is the actual stimulus input to the system and what is our physical means for receiving it and turning it into neural energy? And then also, how do we see color from this and how do we process other visual features? And then perception is how do we perceive visual information. Okay, so the input for vision is light, right? So light, energy, electromagnetic waves. Different features of these waves affect different aspects of our vision. So we have the wavelength of these waves will affect the hue that we see, right, the kind of color we see, which is this top image here, or rather this left image where you see the blue wavelength versus the red wavelength differ in how far it is between the peaks and the wave. And then amplitude gives us the brightness of the input, right, of the stimulus. So how high are these waves, right? Waves with a higher amplitude give you a brighter image than waves with a smaller amplitude, which give you a duller image. Okay? And we know that only part of the light spectrum is actually visible to humans, and surrounding that are ultraviolet and infrared, and many other fun things, right? But we're just going to be talking about perception within this visible spectrum for humans today. Okay, so our apparatus is obviously the eye, right? So in order, light first enters through the pupil, and the size of the pupil is controlled by our iris, which is the colored muscle in our eye. And then the light passes through the lens, and it's focused onto the retina via changes of the curvature of the lens, which is called accommodation. And it projects an inverted image onto the retina, right? So the candle that you're seeing will appear upside down on your retina. And then the retina's millions of receptor cells convert the light energy particles that are striking it into neural impulses. And this is where information processing begins in the visual process. Neural impulses are then sent to the brain via the optic nerve and sent via the thalamus to the visual cortex. Okay, so basic rundown of vision. And in the visual cortex, lots of complex information processing happens. Questions so far? You're with me. Okay. Cool. So, the retina. What's going on in the retina? First, the light. Okay, so this surface here, you can see the eye on the left, right? Light's coming in and striking this region in the back of the eye. And then here is kind of a zoomed-in cross-section of the retina. You see that light goes all the way in first and hits your receptor cells, your cones and your rods. And then it's channeled back out via the bipolar cells and the ganglion cells into the brain. So light goes all the way in, hits the cones and rods, and then works its way back out into the ganglion cells, which then form the optic nerve and send the information to the brain. Okay? So where the optic nerve leaves your retina, you have a blind spot. Okay? There are no cones or rods there. There's only ganglion axons. And so you have no receptor cells in that spot, creating a blind spot in your eye. So I'm going to see if you can find it right now. If not, there's an example in your textbook that I know will work. Okay, so what you're going to do is close one eye. Okay, so close your left eye. Let's leave our right eye open. And look at that little cross. Okay? Now take your finger or your pen or pencil, keep staring right at the cross, and move it gradually to the right until you notice that it's just not there. It's only like a small spot where your finger will disappear, and you have to stare at the cross. You can't look at your finger, or you will see your finger. Can you find it? Finger or pencil, whatever. Same thing. I found it. Uh-huh. I can't see the tip of my finger, right? So if you close your left eye and move the finger gradually to the right while you're staring at the cross, you will lose your finger for a second. Anybody else? Yeah. Give you another second with that. It's cool if you can find it. Okay, so you guys are cute. Why don't we notice this most of the time? Because both eyes are open, exactly, and we're constantly moving them around to make up for this loss of information. Very good. Cool, so you have a blind spot, trust me. If you can see out of that eye, you have a blind spot. So check it out in your textbook. Here's a cool example. All right? Moving on. So, sorry. Here's another diagram of the retina's multiple layers in case this makes more sense to you. You see the light goes all the way down to the bottom and hits the receptor cells first into the rods and the cones, and then works its way back up through the middle layer where the bipolar cells are and the ganglion cells, and then to the optic nerve fiber, which leaves the eye at the blind spot. Okay? So, just another view of the retina. So the receptor cells in the back of our, or in our retina, there's two types, and the fovea is the retina's area of central focus, where there's the highest concentration of cones, which is one of the types of receptor cells that we have. So rods are these kind of taller, skinnier ones here. These are the receptor cells that are sensitive in low light, okay? And they only see black and white. Okay, so rods are dominant in our peripheral vision, sensitive in lower light. Cones, in contrast, are these kind of fatter guys. These are receptor cells that are sensitive to different wavelengths of light, meaning it gives us color perception. Okay, we're going to go into more detail about both of these. So rods are sensitive to light and dark, but they're low in precision for detail because they share bipolar cells with other rods. Okay, remember how the information goes all the way to the receptor cells and works its way back out through the bipolar and the ganglion cells? The rods share bipolar cells with other rods. We know that rods predominate in our peripheral vision. Okay, so you have more cones in your kind of central vision, more rods in your periphery, and they remain sensitive in dim light. So rods are what let you see in very low light, where there's not a lot of color perception going on anyway, right? It's just very low. That's when your rods are working. An example of rod function is this, the Hermann grid, which demonstrates lateral inhibition. Is it working? Can you see the dark spots? Yeah, so if you are focused on just one of these white intersections, you'll see these dark spots appearing in the other white intersections, right? And this is due to something called lateral inhibition, which is where a rod is sending a light signal to the brain. It's saying there's light here in this one spot that you're focused on, right? But firing this signal prevents the neighboring cells from firing their light signals, okay? So you're focused on one light spot, and that makes you less able to actually accurately perceive the other light spots because this increases our sense of contrast, okay? So there is a function to it in that focusing on the light in one area reduces our sensitivity to the light in other areas, but it's to help us see lines, angles, contrast better, okay? So just one of many optical illusions out there. This is demonstrating the rods. And then the cones are our other type of receptor cell. These are sensitive to different wavelengths of light, as I said, so they give us color vision. These are concentrated in the fovea, which is the area of our retina that's very good at perceiving detail because it has so many cones. They're very precise and good with detail because they each have their own bipolar cell devoted to them. Right? Remember, the rods are sharing these bipolar cells. Cones each have their own unique kind of pathway to the brain. Okay, so they're better with detail. They're ineffective in dim light. Right? You can't see a lot of color when you're like sitting in a movie theater waiting for the show to start. And there are three types of cone cells that are sensitive to different wavelengths of light, short, medium, and long, which correspond to three different hues. Right? So we're going to talk about two different theories of color vision and how it is that we see color. So first is the trichromatic theory, which states that we have three types of cones that respond uniquely to three different types of light, right? Three different wavelengths associated with different colors. So we have red cones, green cones, and blue cones. Okay, pretty simple. They respond to the wavelengths that hit them, and they send the signal to the brain. In contrast, we have opponent process theory, which states that instead of having three types of specialized cones, they think that color originates from three different types of retinal processes, meaning activity in the retina and in the brain. And there's three sets. One sees red versus green, one sees blue versus yellow, and one sees white versus black. Okay, so three different opponent processes. And a neuron that's a red-green neuron can be turned on by red, but at the same time it's turned off by green. Okay, so it cannot deliver red and green at the same time. So if you're seeing red, you're activating these red-green opponent processes. You're seeing more red and less green. So here's a little bit of support for the cone, the trichromatic theory. So we have three different types of cones. These are images of cones in the living human retina. They've been colored to look like this. They're not actually the colors that they respond to, right? But this is a representation of what the cones look like. And you can see that they differ greatly from person to person in terms of how many they have that sends different types of colors and how they're organized. Kind of cool. So this is physiological evidence for trichromatic color theory, right, that we do have three types of cones that respond uniquely to different wavelengths of light. Okay, and we know that the colors we perceive are due to mixtures of three wavelengths of light, right? So blue is the shortest wavelength, whereas red has the longest wavelength, green's in the middle. So trichromatic theory states that our cones respond to three colors, right? And that the response depends on the mixture of color that's reflected from the object or the surface. So if you're looking at something that's yellow, right, like that yellow splotch on the paper or the yellow trichromatic theory font, what's happening is green and red is being reflected from that surface, okay, and that's why you're seeing yellow. It's activating your green cones and your red cones and producing this perception of yellow. This is might seem super weird, right, because you're saying, okay, so if I'm combining red and green, I'm seeing yellow, I don't get it. You have to think about lights additively or color additively instead of subtractively. Okay, so subtractive color is what we see when we're like mixing paints and dyes, right? You mix yellow and blue, you get green. Okay. In contrast, additive color is like if you are working in the theater, right, and playing with the gels on the lights, you see that if you combine red and green, you actually get a yellow light. Okay, so you just, it might seem like it doesn't make any sense, but it's because we're used to working with the other kind of color, okay, subtractive. If you think about additive color, it starts to make sense. Okay. So within trichromatic theory, the idea is that in this top left box, where you would see just, you're only getting red light, you see red. Where you're getting red and green light, you're seeing yellow. And down at the bottom, when you're getting all three colors, red, green, and blue at the same time, you see white. Okay? So if you look at the center of this diagram here in the additive, if you mix all the colors together and shine light through it, if you're thinking about like little pieces of colored plastic, you would get white light because it contains all other wavelengths of light. White light is a mixture that contains all. Okay? Yellow, red. Yeah, sorry. There we go. Okay, so pointillist paintings, similar to like color TV phosphors, which are kind of going by the wayside now that we have LED cool technology, used additive colors when their spots of paint did not overlap. So these yellow-looking regions in the painting are actually populated by red and green dots, okay, producing this color. In contrast, our typical paintings use subtractive color, as I mentioned. So within trichromatic color theory, we're going to get back to opponent process in a second. Within trichromatic color theory, we can think about color blindness, okay? Such that color blindness means that you lack either red sensitive cones or green sensitive cones, okay? Or both, which results in you only seeing some types of color. So if you are lacking red sensitive cones only, you have dichromatic color vision. If you're lacking both red sensitive and green sensitive, you have monochromatic vision. We know that this tends to emerge more in men than in women. 8% of men experience some form of color blindness, which is a lot, right? Anybody in here colorblind? Yeah, a couple people, okay. So if you're colorblind, you would have a hard time reading the numbers that are embedded in these images on the right because they're embedded in the kind of color that you are lacking the ability to sense because you're lacking that form of cone in your retina, okay? So monochromatic folks, here's the weird part, can still see yellow. Okay, so if you're missing red cones and green cones, theoretically you shouldn't be able to see yellow, right? Because these are the two kinds of cones that are firing when you're seeing a yellow surface or image. So there's something missing from this theory. Okay, there's a hole, meaning we need to think about opponent process. So remember that opponent process color theory states that there are three retinal processes going on that give rise to color vision. There's red-green, there's blue-yellow, and there's black-white. So, you've probably seen this before, but stare at the white spot in the middle for like 20 seconds, please. Keep staring. See it? Did it go away? A little? Do you see the American flag in its correct colors, at least fleetingly? Right? So yellow left a blue after image, green left a red after image, and black left a white after image, right? Corresponding to the three opponent processes that we've been talking about. So how is this happening? How would you explain this? Do you have ideas? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes, they're still going, but in the opposite direction all of a sudden. They're overcompensating. Okay, so very good. So your neurons are firing like crazy in response to let's say, the yellow-blue at the bottom, right, the upper left corner of the flag. You've been staring at this yellow field for a long time, and it's turning on this yellow response of the neuron for an extended period of time. And then when you wear it out, when you're using it so much, you essentially wear it out, and then when you view a white image, you see the opposite. You see its opponent color kicking in. Okay? So a neuron turned on by red is turned off by green. So after using its red response for a long time, it overtires the red response, and then when you view a white field, which contains all colors, right, we were just saying, only the green response is firing normally. Okay, there's fatigue now going on in one of these opponent processes that's giving rise to an image that's simply not there. So if this helps you make sense of it, you can think of this red-green neuron. So you have originally kind of a white image, and then you're looking at this red field for a very long time. Okay, this is a red-green neuron. It's kicking in its red response. So it's firing white at baseline, and then it fires above baseline signals of red for an extended period of time. Then when you see white again, it rebounds and fires the opposite signal. Okay, it's tired out its red response. It's accidentally firing this green response for a little bit because its red response is fatigued. So all it can do is its opponent process. Okay? All right, so how do we resolve these two theories of color vision? We know that we do have three types of cones. Okay, so neither of these are totally wrong. We know that the retina's red, green, and blue cones respond in varying degrees to a color stimulus in support of trichromatic color theory, but then the signals are processed by the retina and the nervous system, the nervous system's opponent process cells in the retina and the thalamus that gives rise to these kind of fleeting after images and helps us make sense of our input. So this is the opponent process theory. So they're both right. They work together. The information first goes to the three types of cones, and then your brain processes it in a way that's consistent with opponent process theory. Okay? I know color vision is confusing. Read the chapter, see what you think, and we can talk more about it on Thursday when you have concrete questions. Okay? We're not quite done. We're going to talk about other things for the last 7 minutes, and then we can come back to color on Thursday after you've read. Okay? Cool. So, the retina sends this information out via our blind spot, right, via the axons of these ganglion cells, and it's sent through the optic nerve, which is what those cells make up, via our thalamus to our visual cortex in the back of our brain, right, in the occipital lobe of our brain, and it's processed in the visual cortex. So each retinal area corresponds to a specific location in the visual cortex. Come on. Okay. And we generally take this vision input from light, right? But our retina cells are so sensitive that even pressure will trigger our retinal cells to fire. Okay, so I have another demonstration for you guys. Okay, so turn your eyes to the left and close them. And then gently rub the right side of your right eyelid. Okay, so look left, close your eyes, and rub the right side of your right eyelid. You have to look pretty far to the left while you're doing it. What do you see? Is there a spot of light? Where? It's in the far left, right? Good. So the brain is interpreting this pressure as light coming from the left and striking the right side of your eyeball, which you're actually stimulating manually, right, via your digit. So it takes this pressure as light input and says, oh, there's some kind of pressure hitting the right side of my retina. It must be from a light source on the left. Cool, right? So this shows you how incredibly sensitive our retinal cells are to input. So even pressure will trigger them to fire. Clear? Questions? Okay. So visual information processing. So in the brain, we have specialized neurons in the visual cortex called feature detectors that respond to particular features of a visual scene. Okay. So edges, lines, angles, motion, even faces. We have very specialized cells that process these distinct aspects of a visual stimulus simultaneously. Okay, so if you're looking at like a video of a bird flying, some feature detectors, some specialized neurons will be attending to color, others will be focusing on motion, others on overall form, and others on depth. Okay, and via parallel processing, we are constantly analyzing all of these aspects of our vision simultaneously. So we don't have to wait for each of these things to kick in. Instead, we're able to rapidly process the input. Okay? So via fMRI methods, we can do this cool thing where we reconstruct activity from this visual information based on fMRI. This is really cool. I'm glad we have time to do this. This is work at Berkeley. Come on, really?
My name is Jack Yellen. I'm a professor of psychology and neuroscience here at UC Berkeley, and my lab works on vision. That's our main focus is on the visual system. Vision is a really important thing to work on because humans are very visual animals, and when humans have damage to their visual system, they're really incapacitated. And natural vision is more like watching a movie. So essentially, we were trying to build a model that describes how your brain responds to movies. So the external world is a certain kind of movie. We want to be able to build a dictionary that will allow us to accurately predict what the brain activity would be that would be evoked by that movie. And then given some brain activity, we want to be able to reconstruct the movie that you saw. So on the left here, we have a movie that we showed you about 15 minutes. And on the right, we have a brain. And you can see the brain activity is painted here on the side of the brain. But the brain's kind of crunched up in the skull, so it's hard to visualize. So we kind of inflate it, and then we flatten it out, and we can see a flat map of the visual cortex and the rest of the brain as the person watches the movie. The problem here for us is to translate between these movies that occur and this pattern of brain activity. And in the study we talked about in our paper, we just modeled this very back part of the brain, the early visual system, primary visual cortex. And that part of the brain responds to the little local features in the movie, little edges and colors and pieces of motion and texture. But this part of the brain doesn't know anything about what the objects are in the movie. First, we put people in the night for several hours, and we show them movies, and we build a model of their brain. And then in the second part, we put them back in the night, and we show them new movies, and we measure their brain activity, and we decode their brain activity in order to reconstruct the movie. So on the left here is the movie we actually show people, and on the right is our reconstruction. When the movie that we showed has a fairly common object like a person, our reconstructions are actually fairly accurate. When the movie that we showed is something rarer, which you'll see in a second, like this abstract thing, then our reconstructions are coarser. I think you'll be able to use this kind of technology for communicating with people who can't communicate, like locked-in patients or people with neurological diseases. I think you could maybe use this in some forms of psychotherapy or dream analysis. I think there's a lot of potential clinical applications. When this model worked, we were very happy because it was really quite surprising that it would work at all. We're only taking snapshots of the brain every 1 or 2 seconds, and our reconstructions of movies happen at the movie room. So that's much faster, and there's no reason one would think that this would work. And in fact, most of our colleagues just told us this would never work. So it was pretty surprising and satisfying that it actually worked.
Okay. So how cool is this? They can take brain imaging data and reconstruct what it is that you were seeing when that data kind of occurred in your brain. So you're able to take the brain activity and kind of reverse it and see what it was that you might have seen when your brain was lighting up in that way. Isn't that cool? So you can like reconstruct memories or imagination scenes based on activity in the visual cortex. Okay, so talk more about this on Thursday. We'll see you then. Thank you very much for your attention.